Let's move on to agenda item 7, Central Coast LID Initiative Project Update.
So item number 7 is a presentation status report on the Regional Board's Low Impact Development Initiative. As you know, this was established by the board in 2008 to support the implementation of low impact development, and it provides technical assistance to the Central Coast LID stakeholders with a focus on supporting implementation of LID by municipalities. Presenting today is Darla Inglis, who is the Central Coast LID Initiative Program Director.
Thanks. I'm Dominic Rock. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board.
Good morning.
Dominic Rock with the Water Board staff, and I just wanted to make a brief introduction to Darla's presentation item number seven. She's going to share with you some of the progress and work to date that the Central Coast Low Impact Development Initiative, or sometimes we call it LIDI, L-I-D-I, has completed over the last year or so. But before I do, I wanted to just provide you with a brief and convey kind of the overall financial status and health of the LID fund. Included in your staff report, which is just a two-page item for item number 7, I've included some figures that describe the overall financial condition, and I wanted to just bring to your attention that we do have currently over $2 million in the LID fund, including operating fund that can be expended without spending down the endowment of $2 million. I've included a table that summarizes the income and the expenses of the whole project over its lifespan, which commenced or was started in 2008. So through the present, income to the fund has primarily been from returns on investments of the principal, and they've included over $700,000 in investment returns, which is quite remarkable given the economic conditions and the market conditions we've faced over the past few years. But we've also diverted three supplemental environmental projects to the LID fund for a total of $272,000. So the total income for the fund is close to $1 million on top of the two that was originally allocated. And then our expenses for the Low Impact Development Fund include the funds that go to the LID initiative and Dr. Inglis' work. And those are close to $500,000. But overall, we've consulted with other entities and other groups, and we've expended over $1 million there. As an administrative cost to managing the LID fund, the Bay Foundation of Morro Bay does recoup some costs for that. And we've indicated here in the table that the administrative expenses to date have been about $103,000 just from the Bay Foundation. There's some smaller administrative expenses associated with some of the individual contracts as well. But just wanted to bring that into view for you so you had an understanding of kind of the financial context for the work that Darla is going to describe. So with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Darla Inglis of the Central Coast Low Impact Development Initiative.
Okay, one second. Dr. Hunter.
Yeah.
Dominic, thank you very much for giving us that overview. I do have a question because I know the Bay Foundation is a partner in a number of areas in the region, and they have helped to direct considerable funding toward different issues related to Bay and coastal restoration. I'm curious, in their administrative management of the funds, are they directing the investments and helping us to get these remarkable returns? Is that their role in this administrative?
Yes. The Bay Foundation works with a local investment firm that, if I mention his name, some people wouldn't recognize it. But so they basically use the firm to manage the money as the financial manager. But they don't the individual members of the foundation aren't making financial decisions. They're allocating that decision-making to a professional financial advisor.
Okay. All right. I wanted to understand how that, what their role is in the overall set of individual entities, you know, that are working for us. So yep. That's very exciting because I think this is a model for establishing efforts that are directed and focused and targeted on specific aspects of work that we would like to support in different ways, but that also is very, very difficult to find federal or grant public monies to support these efforts and to sustain them so there's continuity. So I'm very, very impressed, and I'm delighted because I greatly value Dr. Inglis' work, and I'm looking forward to hearing her report today. Thank you.
If you heard that, good morning.
Good morning.
As Dominic said, my name is Darla Inglis. I'm the director of the Loan Pack Development Initiative, referred to as LEDI. Today I have with me Melanie Mills, who is a new employee with LEDI, and Melanie has a master's degree in landscape architecture and quite a bit of experience in low impact development. And much of the amazing work that you're going to see today is the result of her fine efforts. So I'd like to introduce Melanie. Before I provide the update on LEDI, I would like to provide some background on low-impact development and stormwater management. It helps to provide the context for the work that we do, and I think it will be helpful given today's agenda item. So let's start with the impacts of urbanization, and we'll move quickly through this type of background. But when we develop, whether it be a commercial development, residential development, we change the landscape and we change the hydrologic cycle that's on that landscape. Picture at the left shows a natural hydrologic cycle where rain comes down, infiltrates, small amount of surface water runoff, and there's vegetation there that helps with evapotranspiration. When you clear that landscape, the picture on the right, with taking out vegetation, even taking out the top layer of healthy soil and adding impervious surfaces, you start to get increased surface runoff. You get decreased groundwater recharge. You get loss of vegetation and soil that's important to a healthy watershed. So these changes to the hydrologic cycle are often termed hydromodification, sort of the buzzword that you hear out there. In the past, meaning 100 years ago or so, stormwater conveyance was purely about moving stormwater away from point A to point B, really not any considerations for downstream management. In more recent times, the acknowledgement of downstream impacts brought about some methods to try to manage storm events. And what we got was management of large storm events, management of peak flows, large volumes that would go downstream and cause damages, primarily through efforts such as detention vaults and detention ponds, which you see here in this picture. These are facilities that essentially hold water back, huge volumes of water, and then it's released. So imagine a bathtub with a drain. It's ultimately released downstream. And while this has been very helpful in managing big erosive events and downstream flooding, scientifically we have found that this is not adequate to protect downstream resources. The reason why is that in these detention facilities, that water is slowly released out, so that volume still gets to the downstream area, the creek or what have you, and it still causes damage. And also, these systems tend to manage the larger storms. The small storms are not managed. And we now know that those small storms added up over the course of a year carry the greatest annual volume and they carry the greatest annual pollutant load. So these have done a great job for peak erosivity, flood control, but not adequate for downstream protection. I want to share one example of the consequences of this type of management that is essentially the prevalent type of management that we have today. A few years ago, I did some work for the city of Elk Grove. They were updating their comprehensive plan, drainage plan. And let's see if I can get my... So City of Elk Grove, Sacramento, City of Elk Grove is one of those suburb-type cities. From 2001, City of Elk Grove doubled in size. In 2004 to 2005, they were the fastest growing city in the nation. They developed, primarily residential development, but they developed with conventional detention ponds. They're now finding that that was not adequate to restore, protect their downstream resources, and they're facing millions of dollars in retrofit costs for that work. I think the message of this, the compelling message of this, is that these were not decisions that were made 100 years ago regarding stormwater management. These were decisions that were made within the past 10 years, and it's the prevalent type of decisions that we're making today around stormwater management, and it's not adequate. Oops. So some immediate lessons. You can't disrupt the hydrologic process on the landscape and hope to maintain any environmental integrity on that landscape or to the downstream receiving water. Peak management, managing these larger volume storms alone, is not adequate for protection. The volumes from the small storms do matter in terms of environmental protection downstream. And so our conventional management approach is not economically, environmentally, or socially sustainable. We need to do better. And another driver is our population growth. For California, numerous population extrapolations show significant growth for California. This image shows a projection from the California Department of Finance. I got it from the ABAG site. The darker the color, the greater the population increase. That's what's showing on this. It doesn't show all of Region 3. It shows the Monterey area. But essentially what we're seeing is that even as much as we would like to infill and promote infill, people are going to be moving to outlying areas to seek affordable housing, and they will build commercial areas, and they will build all the services that go with that. We will be turning our landscape into hardscape on the Central Coast. And so it's an opportunity for us to be doing stormwater management correctly in a manner that's going to support water supply, receiving waters, climate change, and livable communities. And so that brings us to low-impact development. It's a new evolution, a new way to do stormwater management. It does not replace the conventional. The conventional is still important. Again, flood control, public safety, those are all important. But it's a better and improved way to add in environmental protection. In this model, those volumes for small storms are managed on site, keeping those hydrologic processes there. We mimic those natural hydrologic processes through things like infiltration. And it's achieved through site design and decentralized practices. The site design is very important. The picture on the right, hard for anybody to see, is a site design where North Coast Engineering, local firm, looked at how to reduce impervious surface, where to site bioretention areas. They looked at the whole site. It's very important in the work that we do. If we don't do that, what we find is that people develop conventionally, and then they try to go back in and fit in these BMPs. On an already constrained site, it becomes very costly and technically infeasible. So the site design is very important. As stated, the LEADI was established in 2008 to provide that support to municipalities. The work that we do is generally in three categories of outreach, regulatory compliance, and project design. We work with partners across the region. We're very committed to working with regional, state, and nationwide partners to try to bring the best work to the Central Coast. So some of the examples that I'm now going to be sharing fall into these categories. We have online resources. We have a website, a growing website, that provides technical resources, project information. It's the centralcoastleady.org. A couple years ago, we worked with the California Stormwater Quality Association to create their LID portal, and our two websites are linked with each other, so we share information. We get more statewide distribution of our work that way. We've trained hundreds of stakeholders now since 2008 in this region, with a focus on the municipalities. Everything from basic LID to code updates to design. And we've worked with many other groups giving presentations, workshops, such as the American Public Works Association, ASCE, Home Builders Association, et cetera. The flyer on the left is our upcoming bioretention training that we're going to be providing, that's going to provide very specific design training on bioretention facilities, one of the most commonly used LID techniques. We also have code update work. So I can't stress enough, a municipal code is the playbook of how a project is done, what those requirements are. Demonstration projects are one thing, but the day-to-day implementation of projects, you go to the municipality's code and ordinance structure. So we've been working with seven municipalities in the region to actually update their codes to integrate low-impact development. And just to give you an idea of the specificity, it may sound easy, but this shows a curb cut inlet. And this is all about letting water into a curb so it might go into a bioretention facility. This is all the detail that's needed just to specify that type of design. And that's what the contractor and the builder looks to when they want to know how they're supposed to do their project. It all has to be laid out. It provides consistency, performance, and public safety. It's important that these things are here. So we're working with these groups to update these codes, and these municipalities we're working with have been very open to doing this work, and they've also been educating us on their characteristics of their municipalities. We've also been working on design specifications. So again, this relates to the codes, but anytime you want to go and do a design, you need to know exactly how to do that design. We have found that some of the designs, such as bioretention facilities, such as these planter boxes, are not adequate in California. So we brought in an expert, or created an expert team, I should say, from California, Washington, and Oregon to take the best design that we can find and just have at it, mark it up. These are people who have done this work. They know what's worked and what hasn't worked. And we're updating this, and this will be available to all the Central Coast municipalities and statewide for that matter.
And why hasn't that worked, Darla?
Well, some of the designs, they find that the way that they may or may not compact soil, or the way that they say how a shelf might be laid out next to a street doesn't work, or it fails. And so the designs just need to be improved so they're actually going to be sustainable and that they perform. The team has been very fun. They're even editing. Some of these people were on some of the original design specifications, and they find that they're editing their own material. So what we're going to have in the Central Coast is some of the best designs actually in the West Coast for these facilities. Lastly, on this kind of regulatory compliance front, when you cannot comply on-site and you have to go off-site to meet your compliance, it's called alternative compliance. And we've worked with CSU Monterey Bay to create an outline or a framework for the considerations a municipality needs to think about. Because alternative compliance can be a great benefit, and it can be a great liability. You need to understand the regulatory, legal, and technical feasibility aspects of alternative compliance. And this report, which is in its final draft, will help the municipalities to understand that as they think about creating their own alternative compliance program. We provide technical guidance. We now have three different different technical memos very specific to LID implementation about parking lots and bioretention and planting. Inside these, again, apologies for not being able to see detail, but we provide very technical detail on how to design facilities. These images are all about construction sequencing. Sometimes you get a really great design and it's constructed incorrectly, and you know, you might as well not have done the project. So construction sequencing says, here's how you take that design and you actually construct it correctly so it will perform. So this is an example of the type of material. And I should say that all the material, whenever we can, we provide it in a PDF as well as a native file, meaning it's really frustrating when you go and find a technical resource and you cannot edit it as a municipality to put in your logo or cross-references in your code. You need native files. So we create as much as we can in the native file format so that it can be usable.
Just quickly, can you tell us what you're referring to, I'm not familiar with the term. Is it NADER or
Native?
Oh, Native. I got that term from Melanie. That Native's the original file, so that it's not locked up essentially. So if it's an Excel or Word or a CAD engineering drawing, you can actually go in and manipulate it.
Right.
So usually the resources you find online are in PDF format, and mm-hmm. you can't do anything with that. You have to recreate the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've been really emphasizing is trying to have those native files so that they can be as easily transferable to the municipalities as possible.
Great. Okay, I understand now.
Mm-hmm. And I should have mentioned, likewise, with our trainings, for example, we did a code update training, and we did that on a WebEx, and we recorded it. So you can still go in and access that training if you weren't available and couldn't do it on that date, and hear the presenters as well as follow the slideshow. So we really try to make the information available. We try to make our trainings free because of budget constraints, travel constraints. I went to all the municipalities who wanted to have the LID 101 training. I went to them, traveled so that they could attend and have as many of their staff as possible attend. So a lot of what we do is trying to make sure that any of the information that we're providing is going to be easily transferable to that municipality. There's lots of LID resources online. You just Google it, but how much of it can you actually pick up and use readily? Then most board members heard about a couple of the projects that we're involved with. LEDI helped City of Paso Robles and Atascadero to get urban sustainability grants for fairly large projects, the 21st Street project in Paso Robles and the Atascadero Zoo parking lot project. And there is the poster board of that Paso project here for people to see during the break. And I believe John's here if anybody wants to ask him questions during the break about this fabulous reconstruction project. And then the Atascadero Zoo project has started some frontage road improvements, but the entire inner area is going to be done low-impact development. And both of these projects are great demonstration projects for the region as well as opportunities to partner with some of the local universities, get research cost-benefit information. I don't know, is David Athey here? And David Athey, he is here, and he's the lead for the Atascadero Zoo project. And if anybody has questions about that great project, you can ask him. And then lastly, we do provide just technical consultations sort of ad hoc when people call. And one of these was the city of Santa Maria had a small Veterans Memorial parking lot that they were going to essentially redevelop. And there was an opportunity to put in a very small 20 by 20 bioretention facility on that site. So was it alone saving the world? No. Was it a large project? No. But what we found was that Melanie went in and did the planting design with them. We worked with the engineer to understand the concepts of infiltrating the water rather than just sending it downstream. We worked with the soil lab. These are marked up soils information. The soils labs aren't used to making the engineered soil that goes into a bioretention facility, and we needed to work with them to essentially educate them about what that soil mixture was so that they could provide that to the site. So it was a very small project, but essentially a learn by doing because each member of the staff and the consulting community that worked on that project came away with a better understanding of how to implement a low-impact development project. So as we move into the 2012-2013 work plan for LEADY, we'll stay in the same basic categories of work. You know, the emphasis of these categories changes based on what's going on with the economy and growth and the regulatory requirements. But we'll continue in this vein. Very excited about the work that we're doing. Very excited about the fact that, by and large, the municipalities in this region are very open and wanting to go down the path of low-impact development. It's an issue of resources, technical understanding, you know, time to make that change and that transition. But they've been very, very supportive and fabulous to work with. We'll continue to leverage efforts working with as many partners as we can, bringing in the best expertise, of which I would like to thank the board as well as UC Davis and Cal Poly, if they were here, to allow us to cherry pick that expertise rather than a model where you try to keep all the work in-house. being able to cherry-pick allows us to bring the very best resources to the Central Coast, allows us to build upon existing knowledge, and we're always looking for cost-effective ways to implement low-impact development, because any new stormwater requirements and any changes can be costly, and we want to be able to do the right thing and do it well. So that, in a nutshell, is our update, and I'd be happy to take any questions if you have them.
Mr. Jeffries.
I have two questions. One is that for many years, cities have gone to Zeroscape. And how do you integrate Zeroscape into LID?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. They're very compatible. The idea, the most commonly used LID technique is a landscaping bioretention type technique where you're using vegetation and soils. And so what you do in that design is you meld that design with the type of plants that are drought tolerant, don't require any or very little irrigation, and you're able to essentially meet both objectives in one kind of design in one area. So the areas for the xeriscaping and the landscaping become dual function, stormwater management as well as helping to support native vegetation and xeriscaping. And it's just care and design so that you're not saturating those plants.
Well, I'm sure you're aware that most homeowners, and over the last 25 years when they talked about xeriscape, that they've either paved over their yards.
Ah, that's what you're saying. Okay.
And or they've taken their vegetation out and put in tar paper and then bark or rock or mm-hmm. those type of things, which doesn't work with the LID thing. And of course, then my second question, and you talk about retention, is, and I'm from the Salinas area. Mm-hmm. They're between ground level and groundwater, in some areas is very shallow. So there's concerns by commercial and residential people that if they use the LID theory, then they would have flooding or ponding or water retention above ground level. So how do you work that?
There's two answers, I guess, to that. One is that certainly the ability to meet any sort of retention infiltration requirement is going to be set by the conditions of that natural landscape. If it's a landscape that cannot infiltrate stormwater, then you're going to have limited infiltration and should not be expecting it to do something that a big sand dune can do. So that's one consideration that goes into place. The other is that there are guidelines about when you should take care about infiltrative type best management practices, whether they be LID or large infiltration ponds or otherwise. Are you close to the groundwater? Are you close to contaminated groundwater? You don't want to exacerbate the situation. And so understanding, here's the objective and the goal, and then here's the reality of my site condition, and putting those two together, ultimately you optimize what you can reasonably.
Well, in Salinas Valley, I'm sure you're aware that we have heavy clay layers, and it doesn't percolate well.
Mm-hmm.
And after any event, you have saturation at ground level. So there's not much percolation after that particular period of event. So you have a lot of homes that will flood underneath their, mm-hmm. within their foundation. So that's a concern.
Absolutely. And the geotech on the project would be documenting that type of information, those characteristics, and bringing that into, okay, here's what we can or cannot do reasonably.
Well, I can understand that in a new development, mm-hmm. but what do you do with an area that's already been developed and there's been, now they want to make some remodeling changes or they want to make additions, and then the cities now have instituted the LIDs, makes it very difficult for the homeowner or the commercial landowner to be able to develop that property to the extent that they want.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be other alternatives for them to be able to handle that.
Absolutely. I agree.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. And again, I'm very happy to see the update I wish we heard from you more often, because I know the work is going at a good pace and a lot has happened. So this is great to hear this broad kind of look at what's been accomplished in a short period of time, really, when you think about it. I also have two questions. One is more general, and it refers back to something you said at the start of your presentation when you kind of summarized the key points, and one of them was that current practices are not environmentally, economically, or socially sustainable. And I would like to hear from you just a little bit more about the social aspects that you're in your view, you know, are affected.
Certainly. Well, I guess one can respond in terms of beneficial uses and things like bacterial contamination, loss of recreation abilities, things like that. Usually in the context of talking about low-impact development, livable communities, what we're hearing more is just the general aesthetic, psychological feel of a community. Whether or not you're living in a heat island effect or you're just in a land of concrete and asphalt and everything's hot, you might be suffering from allergens, you don't have walkability, you don't see anything that's green around. And so our hard infrastructure, whether it's stormwater or just the way that we develop in general, has not been very responsive to those other aspects of livable communities. And so some of the research we had done in Seattle, we showed people streets with more greenery, and it was stormwater management, but we didn't tell them that. And those that had more concrete, more, you know, sidewalk, hard pervious surface, and no surprise, they selected that they would want to live in the areas that were greener and had better paths to schools and places like that. Mm-hmm. So the hard infrastructure approach isn't really doing much for the soul of our society, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those benefits that is non-stormwater that comes with low-impact development, these sort of peripheral benefits that are a bit harder, less tangible, hard to put a dollar to them.
Yeah, I have heard that from others who work on this different, under different names, but, you know, the idea of greening neighborhoods mm-hmm. and creating outdoor areas where people feel that they can exercise and move around and mm-hmm. so forth. So I'm glad to hear that, and I think it's an important element of how we develop in the future. And then back to the work that you have done and your outreach and the fact that you have the capacity to offer technical consultation to municipalities. And specifically, I'm wondering if you've had any input or had any requests yet to take a look at the Los Osos situation, which we know is about to break ground on multiple-year project to literally open up every street. Mm-hmm. And there's now complicated by the idea of the seawater intrusion and what that might be doing to the groundwater basin. And so the opportunity to find effective ways to offset seawater intrusion is a question, and I believe the county is interested and has extended themselves to consider what opportunities or what options they have. And I'm wondering if you have had any requests from the county to help in the early stages of planning for the construction that goes on and the ultimate design of where these, recharge, if you will, through infiltration, through, you know, the modes that we know will help keep the water in the basin. Mm-hmm. Have you had any exchange, or is that something on the horizon that you're aware of?
I had some limited requests, 2008, 2009. People, I think, were just feeling out that concept, not so much so now that there seems to be some momentum on the work. The original input that I provided was to really try to evaluate what could be done with storm management in the public right-of-way. I think at the time there was a lot of input about what could be done on residential properties, and it's my professional opinion that while residential properties are great places to educate and you can get some work done, we don't always know whether they are going to be maintained into the future. They do a little bit. I really feel the public right-of-way is often sort of the workhorse. And I, when I left off, I'm not sure where that dynamic was going, parcel versus right-of-way. But I've not been approached recently.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think the seawater intrusion issue is something that has become more defined recently, I would say, in the last year to two. Mm-hmm. The community has, I think, had more information and is now seeking new solutions to, you know, as I said, to kind of incorporate that mm-hmm. into the plan and into the construction and final outcome. So I'm hoping that that is a connection that can be made. I know later today we will have the update, and hopefully we can open that part of the discussion up and see if there's a way to connect the services that your program is offering to the process wherever they are mm-hmm. in their contracting and planning.
Certainly.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. Dr. Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see, a couple of questions. You know, one, we were talking about the social impact, and, you know, there's been some cities in California where, for example, non-native landscaping, and I'm not referring to files, you know, were planted. And the unintended consequence was to cause significant amount of respiratory problems where actually people would migrate in these areas because of lower pollen concentration. And now because of the landscaping of non-natives, actually these areas were not as healthy. So I'm wondering with these LAID program, if the unintended consequence of introducing some time additional vegetation that were not, you know, native to the area would have health consequences.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question, and one that Melanie, again, being an expert on plants, when you look nationally or look in California at the recommended list of plants for bioretention facilities, they're generally fairly long lists. When we went through and Melanie went through and looked at those lists, we found that there were a whole bunch of plants that were just not appropriate at all, either because they produced allergens, you know, known problems in that manner, or they were invasive and would take over, you know, the seeds would move downstream and displace native species downstream, or they just weren't the right plants to be in a bioretention kind of stormwater facility. So in one of the technical memorandums that I showed up on the screen, it provides vegetative guidance. And our list is actually shorter, much shorter list than others that you will see because we are selecting and emphasizing native species that don't have those allergen problems, you know, invasive issues are not a problem. And frankly, in California, let me back up. In other states, the plants often are really the workhorse in a bioretention facility. A bioretention facility, again, being that kind of garden, soil, plant mixture. And the plants can get really lush. I have pictures from Oregon, Portland, Seattle, with these very master gardener-looking type designs with all these plants. Well, in our Mediterranean climate, the plants are not going to be as much of a workhorse in the bioretention design as they are in other places. We're really going to be focusing on the power of the soils and what the soils can do here. So the plant palette doesn't need to be elaborate, nor should it be elaborate. So again, it can be consistent with some of the at least native species in xeriscaping and consistent with the types of plants that would be endemic to the region.
All right. Thank you. And then my second quick question is how long some of these pilot projects have been in place?
So the projects for Atascadero and Paso are not constructed yet. They will be constructed next summer. Okay. So there are not a lot, even statewide, there are not a great number of projects that have been designed and constructed and maintained in a manner that you would say that's a great project to highlight. I mean, there are several.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the, again, I was saying the growth, yes, slow growth, we don't have a lot of examples in the region. There are some, but not mm-hmm. a lot.
Because, you know, one of the thoughts that I had is that, you know, California is notorious for storm events where it's feast or famine. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you set up these designs, it would be great to be able to have scientific documentation, say, okay, here is a picture after a 4-inch rain event over 24 hours and what has occurred, because sometimes, you know, nature can surprise us, even though scientifically we think we got it figured out, and then we're humbly reminded that we haven't figured it out. So I one of the thought that I have is, as some of these template designs are developed, is that we do not move into a path of, you know, hopes of you know, good intention, considering that the history of the last 4 years, for example, we haven't gone through an El Nino cycle. Mm-hmm. We've been in a La Nina cycle, and in fact, 3 consecutive years of drought. So I would think that some of these projects would behave totally differently under those circumstances, and not just the precipitation intensity of a storm on a 24-hour cycle, but correlating the comment from my colleague earlier, is that if you do have soil saturation where you're on a very wet year, are some of these LID practices basically or systems going to potentially fail or overflow, and how do we deal with that?
Correct. So you can't take, you know, my history of working with City of Seattle, it drizzled you to death there. So you didn't
exactly
get high intensity events, and so the systems function differently than the higher intensities that you would get here. And it also, in going into the design, you have to consider, well, in what I'm trying to achieve with that design, am I okay with the system not functioning under certain back-to-back high storms, and that's okay because overall the system is functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be thought through, and I think there does need to be documentation to just see what those systems look like and how they're performing. Thank
All
you.
Right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have one speaker card for this item. We can go to that individual. Did that conclude your presentation for now?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. John Boggs?
I'd like to do the next
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, I see you marked down 7, so we'll just wrap you in to number 8.
Thank you. Very informative presentation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. That was for informational purposes.
So item number 8.
And so I want to thank staff very much for that report. It's always good to see what you guys have been up to and what the future looks like potentially for us. Thank you very much.